can you remember the times that you have held your head high and told all your friends of your Indian claim? Proud good lady and proud good man, your great-great-grandfather from Indian blood sprang, and you feel in your heart for these ones. Oh, it's written in books and in songs that we've been mistreated and wrong. Well, over and over I hear the same words from you, good lady, and you, good man.
I'm the chairman of the Pitt River Nation. My name is Ross William Montgomery. And in the beginning, what I understand, what they've told us, the old people, our ancestors have told us, that we lived in an area covering approximately 3.5 million acres of land. And we've maintained this land. We've lived in it. We can't own it. It's not ours to own. The Great Spirit's put us here to maintain and take care of the land. So when the white man came, he came up here and just started taking things. Now in 1852 or in early 1850s, there was a treaty made with Spain and the United States, Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Now in that treaty, that's when the Spanish came in the southern part of tip of California here, and they made this treaty. And in the treaty it says no lands will be taken without consent of the Indian, just compensation, and due process of law. Well, along about then, they discovered gold in California. And the gold and the Indian was here, and the white man wanted the gold and he didn't want the Indian. So they started killing the Indian. And in 1850s, they made this treaty. And after that, there was more gold in the ground, and they wanted the gold. So instead of making the treaties like they were supposed to do in the beginning, they made 18 treaties and sent them off to where they're supposed to went to be ratified. Well, somebody along the way had pigeonholed these 18 treaties, and they were never ratified. Well, we got into the government, we got us a lawyer, and in 1959, I think it was, they found these treaties, and they found out that it was never ratified. And so the government says, well, there's been a mistake. We took your land without consent, without just compensation or due process of law. So the Indian still owns 70% of the California, technically. That's not the Pitt Rivers. It's all of the Indians in California, from the Mission Indians on up to the Pitt River country here, and covering all the Indians in between. They said we owned the land, and they said they were going to take a vote to either accept or reject this money that they wanted to give us. Now the government said that the land was ours, and they figured they had to make a just compensation in order to make it legal that they have the land, and that they've already got control of it, more or less, and so they want to make it legal so they can really do what they want to do with us. So they said, okay, we'll give you $29.1 million for 70% of California, and which really amounts to about 47 cents an acre. We, the Pitt Rivers, were involved in the voting, and the Indians of California, between the Mission Indians and the Pitts, were involved, and the Mission Indians, they were involved. There was three people going to vote to either accept or reject this money. Now the government went down to the Mission area, Mission country, and they asked them, they explained it to the people. They didn't go out and talk to the people that were farmers or the people that lived with the earth. They just talked to the people living in town, had new cars and what have you. And if they got any money, it would be good because it would be a windfall for them. So the government talked to them and they accepted. They said they voted yes to take the money. Now, the Indians of California, so the government, it got them to vote yes, and the Indians of California were treated the same way. Now, I have people, my mother was from down south, and her people never even got a chance to vote in this vote, and there's thousands of Indians out in the country that never got a chance to vote to accept or reject the money. And so they were tricked into accepting the money. Well, they got to Pitt River here, up here in Altura's country, in 1964, and they took a vote. And the Pitt Rivers voted no, not to accept the money. We didn't want the money. So we knew that the government was going to just, the $29 million that they were going to give us wasn't going to amount to anything. And maybe we'd got $50 or $100 a piece. It's pretty doubtful. Because they paid the lawyers out of it quite a big hunk, and then they told us there would be no monies taken out of it other than that. Now we find that they've taken out approximately between $500,000 and $600,000 for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to create a job for people to tell me, Charlie, and these people sitting around here if we're eligible to accept this money. Now, this doesn't make any sense at all, because the government had went out and took a vote of the people that were going to get this money, of the Indian people. Well, they've been doing this since 1964, this trying to find out our family tree and this and that. That's what they call it. Well, when the Pitt Rivers rejected the money, we told them we can't use the money. The money is no good to us, because we need a land base. We need some place to live, some place to live as people. And so the government said, well, we can't have this happen. These people are the smallest group in California. And with the way the government had it, he said, if either one of these three tribes rejects it, it will nullify the whole thing. So when we rejected, they couldn't really go for it, so they went back to Washington and all got together and created a absentee ballot voting system that they could send absentee ballots out to people. Well, they sent them out to non-Pitt Rivers, Pitt Rivers that haven't lived in this area, at maybe their ancestors lived here, and they were shipped out, and people from all over, and people that were deceased, and then they voted. They had a great big vote. Well, they beat us by about 27 votes, I guess, after they'd created their own people.
What was the result?
Well, the result is that, they beat us by 27 votes, and they're still trying to pay us off. Now, this was in 64, and now, what is it, 72? And they still haven't paid us off. We have been fighting to keep the payment back, and if we possibly can today, convince enough people to go back to their leaders or back to where they came from, and we'll have another meeting in Central California, someplace like Fresno, California, a big meeting to try to explain to the rest of the people how important it is not to accept this money for this land. Once we accept it, we will be nobody. We won't have anything. Within a year, the government will probably have us in CC camps working for the government. They'll probably, instead of send us money, they'll probably send us a bill for what we owe them.
Now that your big eyes are finally opened, now that you're wondering how must they feel, meaning them that you've chased across America's movie screens. Now that you're wondering, how can it be real that the ones you've called colorful, noble, and proud in your school propaganda, they starve in their splendor? You've asked for my comment, I simply will render. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying.
My name is Mickey Gimmel.
How old are you, Mickey?
I'm 27 years old.
What do you do for a living, Mickey?
Well, right now I'm not doing anything. I was going to college at San Francisco State College, and I graduated 2 months ago. The following 2 months after I graduated, I was involved in a federal trial in Sacramento, and I've been off out of that for about 3 weeks now.
Mickey, I'd like you to run something down for us. I want to know how you see your people today from your 27-year-old perspective.
How do I view my people? Well, I view the Pitt River tribe as possibly or probably one of the strongest tribes politically in the country, that I feel that they're years ahead of other tribes that are fighting to get back land, they're fighting the government, they're doing all these things on their own. They've contacted their own lawyers. They do everything without having to rely upon the federal government. And we're attempting to get land back, which is something, get land back or stop land being taken away from the Indian, which is something that all Indians are of course concerned with, because our identity is related to the land issue. When Alcatraz first happened in 1969, it gave Indians all across the country a new view of themselves and gave them something to be proud of. It proved that Indians could get together, all tribes together, working together, unified, and they could stand up to the government and fight the government. So this provided the incentive to our tribe, which has always been a tribe that was independent and fought the government, that never ever gave in any way to the government. We were forced into our lands were stolen from us. We never got a reservation because we refused to sign treaties, and which is makes us unique amongst many Indian tribes in the country. There are a few tribes that still exist that were not forced into or coerced into a treaty signing agreement somewhere along the line, where they lost their lands, they lost their wealth, their religion, many things that are taken away by the government whenever they use force, which they have done with Indian people. Now, our tribe, at the end of 1969, was in a position of being practically right up against the wall, that we were fighting for survival, that we need a land base to for our people to grow upon, to plan for the future. That we're just about to the point in time in history where if we don't take into our own hands our own future, we're going to disappear. We had to fight back. We had to do it. We took a course of action that may have been radical, considered radical by many people, but it was necessary for us in order to survive. And what we were attempting to do was hold the federal government and educate the masses of people that are always sympathetic to Indian but don't really know what they're trying to do. We wanted to provide a program of self-determination to attempt to get back our land, our rights, our identity as Indian people, and we need a land base to do that. We're a tribe that's growing. We're not dying out. And it's mandatory upon ourselves that we strive to get back our lands, a place for our people to grow, a place for our people to be a tribe again, where we can relate to each other as Indian people and not as being on the fringe group of white people, or become made over again into white men, because that's something that we can't allow to happen. And in 1970, at the beginning, early part of the year, the tribal council, we were fortunate enough to meet other people that had ideas that were similar to our own. We talked to some lawyers that were willing to donate their legal services to our tribe. They thought that we were right. They thought we had a good legal position. We had elders in the tribe that had kept alive our history, kept alive we'd fought the government in any way we could up to that point. And we met other Indians that were willing to help us out. And these were the Indians of all tribes. And one of their leaders, Richard Oakes, came here and he helped. He let us know what was happening there, and we organized ourselves to to reclaim all of our tribal lands. And it took us approximately about 6 months before we took a course of action that was a direct confrontation type of action, where we hoped we would get some type of justice from the court system. What we were attempting to do was to occupy lands that were stolen from us, that the federal government said were taken from us, taken illegally, taken without compensation, and that we would build our own towns, our own schools, our own churches, and we'd become a people again. We passed a lot of tribal laws. We made up rules for occupations. The first place we went was to Lassen National Park, and I think there were approximately about 200 people involved, and we went late at night, and the national news media were with us there because we wanted this publicized. We wanted the outside people to know what we were trying to do and the reasons for our courses of action. And we were aware that we probably wouldn't be successful in entering the park, so we had another site available to occupy. And so when we were turned away at Lassen National Park, we went to Pacific Gas and Electric Vacation Campground for their employees that get to have a vacation, I guess. And approximately 150 people entered this campground, and the news media were there, and we made a proclamation to the president, to the people of the United States, that we were reclaiming all of our tribal lands, and this area amounted to approximately 3.4 million acres, or an area of land about the size of the state of Connecticut. And our legal position was that all of this land was taken illegally, without compensation, without consent, and by force, and the government admitted that to us. And what we hoped to do was someplace on our tribal lands have them arrest us for trespass, and if they were willing to do that, they would have to prove that they had some type of title or deed to the property, and we knew that they didn't have that, and so that we knew we had them. And so we went to court. Well, we were arrested eventually after 4 days down at the PG&E camp, and I believe there were 50 some people arrested. They didn't arrest everyone. It was a voluntary type of thing. People just volunteered to be arrested. It wasn't until October. We were arrested in June. It wasn't until October before we had the first trials on that occupation there. But in the meantime, we attempted to... Well, the first place we occupied wasn't government land. It was a large corporation's land. And what we did was we reclaimed not only the federal land, but the land of the large corporations that had a working agreement between them and the government. Actually, these large corporations and the government work hand in hand, and the big businesses are the government. Really, they run and control most of the government's policies, and we thought that PG&E was a good example of a rich corporation that is preying upon the little man and really doesn't care anything about people's rights, or especially Indian people's rights. And this was one of the reasons why we chose PG&E was that they were the primary usurper of the water, that one of the main sources or resources that the Indian has. And they're a large corporation that's making millions and millions of dollars yearly from the dams that are on the Pitt River. And there are 7 dams on the Pitt River, and all the entire watershed behind all of these dams comes from Pitt River country. And it amounts to 1/3 of all of PG&E's power in the state of California. And it's a wealth that we can't even determine ourselves in dollars and cents. And you contrast that with the position of the Indian, who's a family. His family income averages about $1,500. And they haven't even paid a dime. They have never even asked Indians if what they thought about
thought about the destruction of their river, destruction of a way of life that has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. When they put these dams on the river, in essence, they killed the river, and they killed many types of life that the Indian needed to survive. And the salmon is a good example that once the dams were in there, they didn't build fish ladders, that the salmon were never allowed to return to their native homelands to repopulate all of life. Like the Indian depended upon, as part of the natural life cycle too, and he depended upon the salmon to eat. And it was, and the salmon, he always returned to his homeland to have his children and to return to die. That's where he died. And once the dams were stopped, the rivers died, now they're polluted, and the garbage and stuff backs up behind them in these lakes. And those were some of the reasons why we attacked PG&E, because of the masses, because of what they represented. They represent a way of life in this country that is diametrically opposite to the Indian way of life. That we feel that the system in this country of a profit-oriented society that places money and property above human life and human rights is something that the Indian must, in order to survive, oppose. And that's essentially what the Pitt River Tribe was doing. What we've been trying to do is we're still trying to get the federal government to arrest us, to get us into court to determine the land issue, the property issue. Who does have title to the land? What rights do Indian people have? What happened to Pitt River Indians? What's going to happen to them in the future? Because they're not dying out. There are young people that is growing, a tribe that is growing. The bulk of the tribe is under 30. That every year our children still have, I mean our young people are marrying. They're not marrying white, they're marrying Indian. They're concerned about an Indian way, and they don't have a place to go to other than right here. This is our home, and that we need a reservation. We need a land base. We need our own country.
You have no reservation now.
We don't have any right now, and that there is what we're trying to do, is get our lands back. And we feel that we've got an excellent legal issue. We've fortunately got lawyers that agree with us, and we're too well known now to the public, actually, to have it obscured by federal control. You know, it's pretty difficult for them to cover up some of the things that have happened here. Actually, this site right here, Four Corners, is a good example of how the government has always dealt with the Indian people. Here in October of 1970, we had a campground here, and we were here on, it's supposed to be national forest land, and we were here to be arrested on national forest land, the Indian versus the government. And we had a meeting here with the government. We told them that we were all willing to be arrested here. And we built a camp here. We had a Quonset hut here, and they didn't agree with us. They brought in a large force of arms and men to arrest the tribe. Their purpose, they stated, was to arrest our building that we had built here. We had a Quonset hut here, and they were going to tear it down. And the tribe said, well, we've lived here for quite a while. This is our homeland, and we built this with our own labor, and that the building is actually our home too, and that we will, if they tear down our home, well, we're going to fight. And it evolved into a violent confrontation that was one of the first in 60 or 70 years between the government and the Indian. And the people were beaten here. Originally there were 27 people arrested, but they did not arrest all of the people. And there were over 100 armed men on their part. They were heavily armed. They had M16s, which are automatic rifles that are designed to kill on impact, no matter where they hit you on the body. And they had all of the paraphernalia of the riot man. They had the helmets and the mace and tear gas and dogs, and they had rifles. They had several rifles stationed around here. They had snipers across the street, and the people were unarmed. And we were, at the most, 50 or 60 Indians here, and they were old people, young people, babies, women, children, men. There couldn't have been no more than 20 to 30 able-bodied men here to oppose this force of the government. They contended that the reason why they were here was that the Indians were cutting down these trees around here. Well, we were cutting down the trees, and that couldn't be allowed, where in fact the government cuts down millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of trees yearly without giving the Indian anything. We cut down 12 trees, we were going to build a schoolhouse here.
Superstition, you force us to send our toddlers away to your schools, where they're taught to despise their traditions, forbid them their languages, then further say that American history really began when Columbus set sail out of Europe, and stress that the nation of leeches that's conquered this land are the biggest and bravest and boldest and best. And yet where in your history books is the tale of the genocide basic to this country's birth, of the preachers who lied, how the Bill of Rights failed, how a nation of patriots return to their earth, and where will it tell of the Liberty Bell as it rang with a thud over Kinzoa mud, and a brave Uncle Sam in Alaska this year? My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying.
The government forces were led by the National Force Supervisor James Berlin, and he had under his command U.S. Marshals from Sacramento, and they were supported by Shasta County Sheriff's deputies. And this was the fourth mass arrest of the Pitt River Tribe in their attempt to regain tribal lands.
With what were you charged?
We were charged with assaulting the federal officers. It was just the opposite. They claimed that the Indian attacked them.
What did the judge decide?
Well, eventually, after a year and a half of canceled trial dates, that we finally went to trial. And it was a two-month-long trial where the federal government had all of their power. The Indian won. And there were seven of us. They eventually dropped charges against everyone of the federal arrests, except for seven people. And of those seven, the jury found that five of them were not guilty. And in a federal court system, you've got to have a unanimous verdict of not guilty or of guilty. And five were found not guilty, and two were mistrials. And I was one of the persons that there was a mistrial on, and I had two charges of assaulting federal officers against me. And the charges carry a 20-year prison term sentence. So it's not too hard to see why the federal government, what they were attempting to do. They were attempting to get probably the backbone of the movement they felt into jail, and to beat the people up, and the people would probably lose the spirit and it'd never happen again. And by another 20 or 30 years from now, the Indian would be dead. And that's what they've been trying to do for the last, whenever they first created the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and when they first started fighting Indians, was to kill him, exterminate him.
You really believe that the white man's genocide of the red man in the United States is not over?
It's still going on. It hasn't stopped. Its form has taking a different form that is a lot more sophisticated and subtle today. But a simulation is essentially a destruction of his identity. He's not allowed to worship his religion.
I mean, the Indian doesn't fit into the melting pot.
No, and he never will. And we don't want to, and I don't think anyone should strive to be something that he isn't. If to ask an Indian to become a white man is just like asking the Indian to, it's just like asking an eagle to become a buzzard. It's impossible. That's pretty much the way the Indian feels, but he feels powerless in his means that are available to him to fight the force that is trying to kill him. And his education, there is no true history of the Indian today. That's what we want to do. We want to educate our people so that we can write our own history, give people a real history of what this country is all about. Give them a real history from the real people, and that's what the Indian is. He's the original person from this country. He's actually the oldest race on this earth. Nowhere in the world is there a country or a race of people that can trace back their identity more than 5,000 or 6,000 years, maybe 8,000 in China. But certainly the Indian has a history here that goes back 50 to 100,000 years, and it's pure history. It's a pure people that survived for thousands of years living in peace and harmony on the Mother Earth. And that's pretty much the way most Indians that are still Indian feel about their land, because they're not an Indian without their land. That the land is essential to their religion. It's essential to their way of life. They feel like they're a part of everything that is living, and everything that is living is a part of them, and that someday they're going to return to their Mother Earth. And from the Mother Earth springs all life, and it's a continual life cycle that goes on forever. That if you don't exploit those forces of life and pervert them or destroy them, that they will continue on forever. And that's the course that the Indian is his way of life, and that's what we're trying to educate white people to a different way of life, and that's, we want to keep our way of life.
What happens next?
It's difficult for us to know what the government is trying to do. Right now it's possible that the government is thinking in terms of giving the Indian back some of his land, some of the lands that was taken from him. But we'd like to share in some of the wealth that the large corporations and the government share in from our own lands. As I was saying earlier, they make millions, probably billions of dollars over every 10-year span, because this land here is rich land. It's rich in timber, or it was rich in timber. They've been logging it for the last 80 years. They're still logging it. It's rich in timber. It's rich in water resources. I was saying earlier that one-third of all of California's electrical power comes from the Pitt River. There is a large area of land that the Indian could use to survive. That we don't need a 9-to-5 clock to punch into to make our way of living. That we can live off of the land. That's the way we have lived for thousands of years. We'd like to develop maybe small tribal businesses that we could invest that money back into the tribe, and it would be shared by all, because that is an Indian way. But we don't know what the government's move is next, and like, we're going to keep on the government and on the large corporations. We're going to be taking them to court, suing them for trying the legal system. We don't have much faith in it. It never has given us anything other than just lately. We've been found not guilty of being on our own land several times. We've gone through several court trials other than this Four Corners trials. I think there have been about 4 or 5 trials now about the Indian and occupation of someone else's land, and the Indian hasn't been found guilty yet. And the government had such a weak case against us in the Lassen Park, a later occupation of Lassen Park, that they just dropped all the charges together. They arrested 22 people there, and then they dropped the charges because they had no evidence.
But they still keep arresting you, then they can drop the charges later at their own convenience.
But we feel that we are gaining strength. We're showing how weak the government's position is. We've We're educating people every time this happens, that this here is history that is happening today, and the Indian is making it, and it's going to be viewed in a different light. Not, it's being viewed that way right now. Most people feel that there must really be something to the Indians' claim, because the government can't get anything on them, and that our people now, there are several Indians within the tribe that are actually going on to other people's lands. By other people, I mean the federal government or a large corporation such as PG&E or Southern Pacific Railroad or Kimberly-Clark Corporation, and building themselves a home. And we're staking claims to those land. We know that the government has the power to pay a large corporation for a home site for an Indian, and actually they got those lands only in the first place by, you know, some kind of crooked deal between them and the government, where they could exploit whatever resource they were trying to exploit. If there are timber corporations such as Kimberly Clark or Publishers Mill or Watt or fruit growers, of course they're trying to get the timber. PG&E is a monopoly, a power monopoly that is taking all of the water resources. And the land itself, the federal government is exploiting. They lease the land to whites. The Indian gets none of this profit that the government gets. They lease it only to rich people that can put businesses on the land, and they don't allow the Indian or even the white man to actually share in the abundance of life that all people were given by the Creator.
Hear how the bargain was made for the West with her shivering children in 0 degrees. Blankets for your land, so the treaties attest. Oh, well, blankets for land is a bargain indeed. And the blankets were those Uncle Sam had collected from smallpox disease, dying soldiers that day. And the tribes were wiped out, and the history books censored. 100 years of your statesmen have felt it's better this way. Yet a few of the conquered have somehow survived. Their blood runs the redder, though genes have been paled. From the Grand Canyon's caverns to Craven's sad hills, the wounded, the losers, the robbed sing their tale. From Los Angeles County to upstate New York, the white nation fattens while others grow lean. Oh, the tricked and evicted, they know what I mean. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying.
Bill, can you tell a large audience that's listening now what you think would be, at this point in time, in 1972, more than 100 years after the genocide of your people was almost completed by the white man, what now do you think would be a reasonable settlement from the United States government?
To get our land back would be a reasonable settlement.
And do you think there's any chance of that happening, considering the government's history and attitude?
Well, the United States government right now is doing in Vietnam exactly what it's done to the Indians in the past. Exactly. It's always done that. It's never told the truth in its life. Ever since it was formed, it's been a lie from the start. And how is people going to live with a lie? A lie has got to catch up with you someday. And I think it's catching up with it now.
And as we continue, let me do what we didn't have a chance to do. Can I have your full name and tribal title, please?
Willard Rhodes. And the address is Box 64, Big Bend. I am tribal councilman, one of them, of the Istachui Band. That'll be it.
What does that mean?
It's just a name. like California, Oregon, Washington, just a name.
It seems, standing here next to this fire, on this corner of land, where there's a Shell gasoline station across the street, which of course is owned by Dutch interests, and a motel resort across the street, where the owner refuses to give your people so much as a bucket of water. And here we are under the sun and the sky, with the pollution visible even here. It seems, at least to me, as a visitor to this situation, and not a resident of it, that there seems so little hope. Am I missing something?
No. The hope is in the end, what comes out of the end times of things. What most people have forgot, they're built of three parts: physical, mental, and spiritual. And most people have forgot the spiritual part of them. They go on mental and physical power, which isn't enough and will fall down in the end. And this is what the government runs on. It runs on mental and physical power. And before long, it's going to crumble. It's going to fold up. It can't stand because it has no spiritual power. To tell these kind of stories or talk like this, you have to tell stories. Maybe you have to go back and tell the beginning of things. Maybe that would be the simplest and easiest way. Let me get out of this smoke. To tell this kind of thing, I gotta sit down. I'm lazy. In the beginning, in the other world, before people came here, they had everything that we've got today. Everything. They listened to news on webs. They watched what was going on in looking at a box, I guess you'd call it. They didn't have to walk, they rode. They could fly in the air. People had everything, but they forgot the old man. They said, we don't need the old man. We're powerful enough ourselves. We can make it on our own. We don't need that God. What is he? What good is he? He doesn't do anything for us. So the old man got mad. And he said, I'm going to destroy this world. So he told his helper, the man that done his work for him, which we call the Kwan or the fox. He said to the fox, he said, you go make a web, a big web, he said. And what people that you know that hasn't forgotten me, he said, you put them on this web and I'll make another world for them. And you take them over there and we'll destroy this one. So he made another world, and the fox made this web. And he gathered the people that remembered the old man, and he put them on this web. Then he was just about ready to cut her loose and take off from that world, and the old coyote, who was the devil's helper or worker, I might as well say his name was the old coyote who called him the Jamal. He worked for the Wheatla. So he happened to see what was going on, and he ran over and he grabbed a hold of the rope that held this web up in air. And he said, I know what you're going to do. You're going to destroy this world. He said, take me with you. The fox said, no, I can't do that. He said, you caused too much trouble. So he begged, and he begged, he said everything. Finally, long towards the last, he said, it's wrong, he said, to kill your brother. So the fox took him, and he brought him to this world. And he told the old coyote, he said, if you do wrong, if you make people do wrong again, he said, I'll have to destroy the people again. I'll have to get rid of them again. He said, and we'll drown them next time. He said, we'll flood the world. So it went on for years and years and years, and people forgot. They forgot the old man again. So he told the old fox, he said, you make a canoe, big one. He said, long, that'll pack enough groceries for you to last 7 years. And he said, then make a little canoe. And he said, and put all the seeds of everything in it, the trees, the animals, everything, all kind of seeds put in there, even the little bugs. He said, because I'm going to destroy it all. But I want to save these because I made them. A new start. So he did. He made his, built his canoe, and he built the other, and he gathered everything, and he put in this little boat, and he covered it up. And then it started to rain, and he got in his big canoe, and he sat down, and he waited. And finally the water got about knee-deep, I guess, and the old coyote began to think, boy, he said, when's this rain going to stop? And he got up to his belly button. He said, I know what's happening. He said, they're flooding this world. He said, I remember now. I was told this long time ago what would happen. So I better find my brother, he said. I better find that old fox. So he started looking, and finally he found him. And he grabbed a hold of the boat, and he said, take me with you. He said, I don't want to die. He said, I remember I done wrong. He said, I forgot. He said, you know how people are, they forget. He said, forgive me. He said, I won't do it again. He said, take me along. He said, I know you're going to build it over again. So the old fox said, well, all right. After he said, I'm your brother again, he took him along. And he said, do you have to sleep for 7 years until you're done? Well, so far, you find out what happened. Now, you can read your own Bible and find this in it. See, our stories go back a little bit further, and they come up to here. Now, this is after the flood. So the old coyote, well, after this flood, well, he made another, this land, this island, or this Echistu, what we're living on. He fixed this out of his hair. And when he landed here, there was no trees, nothing, barren. Wasn't a thing on here. And the old coyote jumped out of the boat, and he looked around. He said, how are we going to live here? He said, we can't live on this island. There ain't nothing to eat here, he said. No trees, no people, nothing here, he said. So the fox told him, he said, well, you go over on the other side. He said, I already fixed another island over there, he said. And there's people over there. He said, now you go over there and you behave yourself. You teach some people good things. Old coyote said, all right, I'll do that. And he made all kinds of promises again. But he didn't keep his promises. Then after the old coyote was gone, well, he planted everything here, all the trees, all the everything. And then he turned two doves loose. He said, now you live way up high. He said, don't come down. He said, you stay way up. He said, someday that old coyote's going to come back here, and he's going to try to get rid of you. He'll try to kill you. So don't come down. So they lived up high and remembered the old man. And they raised a big family. It must have went on for thousands of years. And finally, the old coyote came back. He landed over there in the East Coast. Got out of his boat, looked around. He said, boy, he said, this is sure a pretty place. I should never left here. I shouldn't have went. He said, there must be people here. Sure, he said, that fox wouldn't build this and not put people here. There must be people here. So he looked for it, and he found it. And he couldn't climb up. He tried to climb up to get to those people, but he couldn't make it. So he said, I got to get rid of them people. This is too good for them. But I can't climb up there. So he thought. He said, well, I know how I can do it. I'll lie to them. He said, I'll trick them. I'm pretty good at that. He said, I'll trick them. I'll get them down. So he went up there, and he hollered up to the people. He said, I come from where the sun rises, he said, and I'm going to go where the sun sets. And I'm hungry, he said. I'm kind of tired, he said. I don't feel like climbing up there to where you are, he said. So if you'll just give me one of your children, throw it down, he said, I'll eat that and I'll go on my way. And I won't bother you no more, he said. That'll be all I'll do. That's all. So the old people, they kind of forgot what the old man had told them. So they gave him one. The oldest one. He volunteered, so he come down, the old coyote ate him, and away he went. Pretty quick he come back. Well, maybe a month or two he come back. He said, I couldn't get across over there. He said, I'm going back where I come from. He said, But I'm hungry again. He said, just give me one more, he said. This is the last one. Now, just give me one more. I'll eat that. Then I won't bother you no more. I'm going to go home, he said. So they give him another one. The old coyote went back over to where he left his boat, and he stayed around there for a while. Pretty quick, he come back again. He said, I forgot how I came over. I forgot. He said, I don't know how I got over here. I forgot the way back. He said, but I'm hungry again. Give me another one. And he'd done this for a good many years until he ate putting all the people up, all but two young ones and the two old ones he didn't get. The old one said, we can't give you no more. If you want to kill us, you come up here and get us. And the old coyote could never climb up to get them last four people, the two young ones and the two old ones. And this is where we are today. This is the story. This was prophesied from back to the, from the other world. It's that old of a story.
What happens next to the people, the four people, the two old ones and the two young ones? Do they get the coyote or the fox?
I left that time. I never heard the other story.
Your message is then that we still have time to wait and to learn.
You have time.
The past, it just crumbled. The future just threatens. Our lifeblood shut up in your chemical tanks. And now here you come, bill of sale in your hand, and surprise in your eyes that we're lacking in thanks. For the blessings of civilization you've brought us, the lessons you've taught us, the ruin you've wrought us. Oh, see what our trust in America's bought us. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying.
If people like, well, if the white people would read their Bible without going to church, without paying any attention to what that preacher says, just read it. He will learn a lesson. He will learn a lesson. He will find that when he goes someplace, he must obey the rules of those people. He must do as those people did and live as those people did and not try to change it. But as the old coyote is, he wants to change everything. As the old devil wants to change everything. There's a story in the Bible that fits pretty much of what's happened today. You know, the old devil, he took Christ way up on a mountain. He said, look, he said that all the pretty things down there, the valleys down there, he said, the big cities, he said, everything down there. He said, if you'll obey and bow down to me, he said, you can have all of those things. And the Christ told him, he said, get behind me, he said, old devil, get behind me. For the simple reason he said that is because the Christ already owned everything. The old devil didn't own nothing. Now this is exactly what the white people are telling the Indian. They've made all kinds of programs. They said, come here, look there. If you'll join us, if you'll join our former government, you can have all these programs. Look at them, they're pretty. You can have schooling, you can have hospitals. He's offered all these things, all these kind of programs. Now, if the Indian accepts all of these programs, he's bound down to this government or the devil, which the Indian story says that he is the devil. He plainly says it. The Bible will tell you the same thing. If you'll read some of the scrolls or some of the books that were taken out of the Bible so that people couldn't read them, find them and read them, and they'll tell you this very same thing. So we can't accept this kind of this kind of a settlement, this kind of a deal.
The white man in this country has killed your people, has destroyed your people, destroyed the land, but specifically your people. If you were 30 to 50,000 strong in the 19th century, you are now 500 weak. How can you expect the same people, essentially, to turn around and say, here is that land back?
There's a story in the Bible, too. It said about a great king. He had a great army. He had a big giant. One of his soldiers was a big giant. He could whip anybody. He wasn't afraid of nobody. It was one little army, little king. Nobody, and all his soldiers were afraid to fight. But this one little shepherd, one little man, said, I'll do it. I'll go and take your place of the whole people. So he went with his little tiny little slingshot, and he conquered the whole army. It doesn't take a big man. It doesn't take a whole army. It takes little people with common, ordinary sense that the good Lord gave you in the first place. Use it. Combine your three parts and use them. Combine your physical with your mental and your spiritual parts. Put them together and use them. Don't try to use just spiritual because you can't make it on just spiritual. You can't make it on just mental power. You can't make it on just physical power. You'll fall, you'll crumble, you can't stand. You have to have all three. And if you put all three to work, anything will work for you.
Do you think that in the time of your children or grandchildren, that there will be real justice? Or do you think there will be just fewer Pitt River Indians?
Until the white man grafts himself back into the true tree of life, there will never be justice.
Has a change come about, Uncle Sam? Or are you still taking our lands? A treaty forever George Washington signed. He did, dear lady, he did, dear man. And the treaty's being broken by Kim's or Dam. And what will you do for these ones? Oh, it's all in the past, you can say. But it's still going on here today. The government now wants the Iroquois land, that of the Seneca and the Cheyenne. It's here and it's now, you must help.